Chapter 7. How war came to New York. 1. The city of New York was in the year of the German attack the largest, richest, in many respects the most splendid, and in some, the wickedest city the world had ever seen. She was the supreme type of the city of the scientific commercial age. She displayed its greatness, its power, its ruthless anarchic enterprise, and its social disorganization most strikingly and completely. She had long ousted London from her pride of place as the modern Babylon. She was the center of the world's finance, the world's trade, and the world's pleasure, and men likened her to the apocalyptic cities of the ancient prophets. She sat drinking up the wealth of a continent as Rome once drank the wealth of the Mediterranean and Babylon the wealth of the East. In her streets one found the extremes of magnificence and misery, of civilization and disorder. In one quarter, palaces of marble, laced, and crowned with light and flame and flowers, towered up into her marvelous twilights beautiful, beyond description. In another, a black and sinister polyglot population sweltered in indescribable congestion in warrens and excavations beyond the power and knowledge of government. Her vice, her crime, her law alike were inspired by a fierce and terrible energy, and like the great cities of medieval Italy, her ways were dark and adventurous with private war. It was the peculiar shape of Manhattan Island, pressed in by arms of the sea on either side, and incapable of comfortable expansion, except along a narrow northward belt, that first gave the New York architects their bias for extreme vertical dimensions. Every need was lavishly supplied to money, material, labor, only space was restricted. To begin, therefore, they built high perforce. But to do so was to discover a whole new world of architectural beauty, of exquisite ascendant lines, and long after the central congestion had been relieved by tunnels under the sea, 4 colossal bridges over the East River, and a dozen monorail cables east and west, the upward growth went on. In many ways New York and her gorgeous plutocracy repeated Venice in the magnificence of her architecture, painting, metalwork and sculpture, for example, in the grim intensity of her political method, in her maritime and commercial ascendancy. But she repeated, no previous state at all in the lax disorder of her internal administration, a laxity that made vast sections of her area lawless beyond precedent, so that it was possible for whole districts to be impassable, while civil war raged between street and street, and for Alsatias to exist in her midst in which the official police never set foot. She was an ethnic whirlpool. The flags of all nations flew in her harbor, and at the climax, the yearly coming and going overseas numbered together upwards of 2 million human beings. To Europe she was America, to America she was the gateway of the world. But to tell the story of New York would be to write a social history of the world. Saints and martyrs, dreamers and scoundrels, the traditions of 1,000 races and 1,000 religions, went to her making, and throbbed and jostled in her streets. And over all that torrential confusion of men and purposes fluttered that strange flag, the stars and stripes, that meant at once the noblest thing in life, and the least noble, that is to say, liberty on the one hand, and on the other the base jealousy the individual self-seeker feels towards the common purpose of the state. For many generations New York had taken no heed of war, save as a thing that happened far away, that affected prices, and supplied the newspapers with exciting headlines and pictures. The New Yorkers felt perhaps even more certainly than the English had done that war in their own hell, and was an impossible thing, and that they shared the delusion of all North America. They felt as secure as spectators at a bullfight. They risked their money perhaps on the result, but that was all. And such ideas of war as the common Americans possessed were derived from the limited, picturesque, adventurous war of the past. They saw war as they saw history, through an iridescent mist, deodorized, scented indeed, with all its essential cruelties tactfully hidden away. They were inclined to regret it as something ennobling, decided it could no longer come into their own private experience. They read with interest, if not with avidity, of their new guns, of their immense and still more immense ironclads, of their incredible and still more incredible explosives, but just what these tremendous engines of destruction might mean for their personal lives never entered their heads. They did not, so far as one can judge from their contemporary literature, think that they meant anything to their personal lives at all. They thought America was safe amidst all this piling up of explosives. They cheered the flag by habit and tradition, they despised other nations, and whenever there was an international difficulty they were intensely patriotic, that is to say, they were ardently against any native politician who did not say, threaten, and do harsh and uncompromising things to the antagonist people. They were spirited to Asia, spirited to Germany, so spirited to Great Britain, that the international attitude of the mother country to her great daughter was constantly compared in contemporary caricature to that between a henpecked husband and a vicious young wife. And for the rest, they all went about their business and pleasure as if war had died out with the megatherium. And then suddenly, into a world peacefully busied for the most part upon armaments and the perfection of explosives, war came. Came the shock of realizing that the guns were going off, that the masses of inflammable material all over the world were at last ablaze. 2. The immediate effect upon New York of the sudden onset of war was merely to intensify her normal vehemence. The newspapers and magazines that fed the American mind for books upon this impatient continent had become simply material for the energy of collectors were instantly a coruscation of war pictures and of headlines that rose like rockets and burst like shells. To the normal high-strung energy of New York streets was added a touch of war fever. Great crowds assembled, more especially in the dinner hour, in Madison Square about the Farragut Monument, to listen to and cheer patriotic speeches, and a veritable epidemic of little flags and buttons swept through these great torrents of swiftly moving young people, who poured into New York of a morning by car and monorail and subway and train, to toil and ebb home again between the hours of 5 and 7. It was dangerous not to wear a war button. The splendid music halls of the time sang every topic in patriotism and evolved scenes of wild enthusiasm. Strong men wept at the sight of the national banner sustained by the whole strength of the ballet, and special searchlights and illuminations amazed the watching angels. The churches re-echoed the national enthusiasm in graver key and slower measure, and the aerial and naval preparations on the East River were greatly incommoded by the multitude of excursion steamers which thronged, helpfully cheering, about them. The trade in small arms was enormously stimulated, and many overwrought citizens found an immediate relief for their emotions in letting off fireworks of a more or less heroic, dangerous, and national character in the public streets. Small children's air balloons of the latest model attached to string became a serious check to the pedestrian in Central Park. And amidst scenes of indescribable emotion, the Albany legislature in permanent session, and with a generous suspension of rules and precedents, passed through both houses the long-disputed bill for universal military service in New York State. Critics of the American character are disposed to consider that up to the actual impact of the German attack, the people of New York dealt altogether too much with the war, as if it was a political demonstration. Little or no damage, they urge, was done to either the German or Japanese forces by the wearing of buttons, the waving of small flags, the fireworks, or the songs. They forgot that, under the conditions of warfare a century of science had brought about, the non-military section of the population could do no serious damage in any form to their enemies, and that there was no reason, therefore, why they should not do as they did. The balance of military efficiency was shifting back from the many to the few, from the common to the specialized. The days when the emotional infantryman decided battles had passed by forever. War had become a matter of apparatus of special training and skill of the most intricate kind. it had become undemocratic. And whatever the value of the popular excitement, there can be no denying that the small regular establishment of the United States government, confronted by this totally unexpected emergency of an armed invasion from Europe, acted with vigor, science, and imagination. They were taken by surprise so far as the diplomatic situation was concerned, and their equipment for building either navigables or aeroplanes was contemptible in comparison with the huge German parks. Still, they set to work at once to prove to the world that the spirit that had created the Monitor and the Southern submarines of 1864 was not dead. The chief of the aeronautic establishment near West Point was Cabot Sinclair, and he allowed himself but one single moment of the posturing that was so universal in that democratic time. "We have chosen our epitaphs," he said to a reporter, "and we are going to have, 'They did all they could. Apostrophe now run away.' The curious thing is that they did all do all they could. There is no exception known. Their only defect indeed was a defect of style. One of the most striking facts historically about this war, and the one that makes the complete separation that had arisen between the methods of warfare and the necessity of democratic support, is the effectual secrecy of the Washington authorities about their airships. They did not bother to confide a single fact of their preparations to the public. They did not even condescend to talk to Congress. They burked and suppressed every inquiry. The war was fought by the President and the Secretaries of State in an entirely autocratic manner. Such publicity as they sought was merely to anticipate and prevent inconvenient agitation to defend particular points. They realized that the chief danger in aerial warfare from an excitable and intelligent public would be a clamor for local airships and aeroplanes to defend local interests. This, with such resources as they possessed, might lead to a fatal division and distribution of the national forces. Particularly, they feared that they might be forced into a premature action to defend New York. They realized with prophetic insight that this would be the particular advantage the Germans would seek. So they took great pains to direct the popular mind towards defensive artillery and to divert it from any thought of aerial battle. Their real preparations they masked beneath ostensible ones. There was at Washington a large reserve of naval guns, and these were distributed rapidly, conspicuously, and with much press attention among the eastern cities. They were mounted for the most part upon hills and prominent crests around the threatened centers of population. They were mounted upon rough adaptations of the dome swivel, which at that time gave the maximum vertical range to a heavy gun. Much of this artillery was still unmounted, and nearly all of it was unprotected, when the German air fleet reached New York. And down in the crowded streets, when that occurred, the readers of the New York papers were regaling themselves with wonderful and wonderfully illustrated accounts of such matters as the secret of the Thunderbolt, aged scientist Perfect's electric gun, to electrocute airship crews by upward lightning, Washington orders 500, War Secretary Lodge delighted, says they will suit the Germans down to the ground, President publicly applauds this merry quip. 3. The German fleet reached New York in advance of the news of the American naval disaster. It reached New York in the late afternoon, and was first seen by watchers at Ocean Grove and Long Branch coming swiftly out of the southward sea and going away to the northwest. The flagship passed almost vertically over the Sandy Hook observation station, rising rapidly as it did so, and in a few minutes all New York was vibrating to the Staten Island guns. Several of these guns, and especially that at Giffords and the one on Beacon Hill above Madawin, were remarkably well handled. The former, at a distance of 5 miles, and with an elevation of 6,000 feet, sent a shell to burst so close to the Vaterland that a pane of the Prince's forward window was smashed by a fragment. This sudden explosion made Bert tuck in his head with the celerity of a startled tortoise. The whole air fleet immediately went up steeply to a height of about 12,000 feet, and at that level passed unscathed over the ineffectual guns. The airships lined out as they moved forward into the form of a flattened V, with its apex towards the city, and with the flagship going highest at the apex. The two ends of the V passed over Plumfield and Jamaica Bay, respectively, and the Prince directed his course a little to the east of the Narrows, soared over Upper Bay, and came to rest over Jersey City in a position that dominated Lower New York. There the monsters hung, large and wonderful in the evening light, serenely regardless of the occasional rocket explosions and flashing shell bursts in the lower air. It was a pause of mutual inspection. For a time, naive humanity swamped the conventions of warfare altogether. The interest of the millions below and of the thousands above alike was spectacular. The evening was unexpectedly fine. Only a few thin level bands of clouds at 7 or 8,000 feet broke its luminous clarity. The wind had dropped. It was an evening infinitely peaceful and still. The heavy concussions of the distant guns, and those incidental harmless pyrotechnics at the level of the clouds seemed to have as little to do with killing and force, terror and submission, as a salute at a naval review. Below, every point of vantage bristled with spectators, the roofs of the towering buildings, the public squares, the active ferry boats, and every favorable street intersection had its crowds. All the river piers were dense with people, the Battery Park was solid black with East Side population, and every position of advantage in Central Park, and along Riverside Drive, had its peculiar and characteristic assembly from the adjacent streets. The footways of the great bridges over the East River were also closely packed and blocked. Everywhere shopkeepers had left their shops, men their work, and women and children their homes, to come out and see the marvel. It beat, they declared, the newspapers. And from above, many of the occupants of the airships stared with an equal curiosity. No city in the world was ever so finely placed as New York, so magnificently cut up by sea and bluff and river, so admirably disposed to display the tall effects of buildings, the complex immensities of bridges and monorailways and feats of engineering. London, Paris, Berlin, were shapeless, low agglomerations beside it. Its port reached to its heart like Venice, and, like Venice, it was obvious, dramatic, and proud. Seen from above, it was alive with crawling trains and cars, and at 1,000 points it was already breaking into quivering light. New York was altogether at its best that evening, its splendid best. "Gaw! What a place!" said Bert. It was so great, and in its collective effect so pacifically magnificent, that to make war upon it seemed incongruous beyond measure, like laying siege to the National Gallery or attacking respectable people in an hotel dining room with battle axe and mail. It was in its entirety so large, so complex, so delicately immense, that to bring it to the issue of warfare was like driving a crowbar into the mechanism of a clock. And the fish-like shoal of great airships hovering light and sunlit above, filling the sky, seemed equally remote from the ugly forcefulness of war. To Kurt, to Smallways, to I know not how many more of the people in the air fleet came the distinctest apprehension of these incompatibilities. But in the head of the Prince Karl Albert were the vapors of romance. He was a conqueror, and this was the enemy's city. The greater the city, the greater the triumph. No doubt he had a time of tremendous exultation, and sensed beyond all precedent the sense of power that night. There came an end at last to that pause. Some wireless communications had failed of a satisfactory ending, and fleet and city remembered they were hostile powers. "Look!" cried the multitude. "Look! What are they doing?" What, down through the twilight, sank 5 attacking airships, 1 to the Navy Yard on East River, 1 to City Hall, 2 over the great business buildings of Wall Street and Lower Broadway, 1 to the Brooklyn Bridge, dropping from among their fellows through the danger zone from the distant guns smoothly and rapidly to a safe proximity to the city masses. At that descent, all the cars in the streets stopped with dramatic suddenness, and all the lights that had been coming on in the streets and houses went out again. For the city hall had awakened, and was conferring by telephone with the federal command and taking measures for defense. The city hall was asking for airships, refusing to surrender as Washington advised, and developing into a center of intense emotion, of hectic activity. Everywhere and hastily the police began to clear the assembled crowds. "Oh, to your homes," they said, and the word was passed from mouth to mouth, "there's going to be trouble." A chill of apprehension ran through the city, and men hurrying in the unwonted darkness across City Hall Park and Union Square came upon the dim forms of soldiers and guns, and were challenged and sent back. In half an hour, New York had passed from serene sunset and gaping admiration to a troubled and threatening twilight. The first loss of life occurred in the panic rush from Brooklyn Bridge as the airship approached it. With the cessation of the traffic, an unusual stillness came upon New York, and the disturbing concussions of the futile defending guns on the hills about grew more and more audible. At last he ceased also. A pause of further negotiation followed. People sat in darkness, sought counsel from telephones that were dumb. Then into the expectant hush came a great crash and uproar, the breaking down of the Brooklyn Bridge, the rifle fire from the Navy Yard, and the bursting of bombs in Wall Street and the City Hall. New York as a whole could do nothing, could understand nothing. New York in the darkness peered and listened to these distant sounds until presently they died away as suddenly as they had begun. What could be happening? They asked it in vain. A long, vague period intervened, and people looking out of the windows of upper rooms discovered the dark hulls of German airships, gliding slowly and noiselessly, quite close at hand. Then quietly the electric lights came on again, and an uproar of nocturnal news vendors began in the streets. The units of that vast and varied population bought and learned what had happened. There had been a fight and New York had hoisted the white flag. For the lamentable incidents that followed the surrender of New York seem now in the retrospect to be but the necessary and inevitable consequence of the clash of modern appliances and social conditions produced by the scientific century on the one hand, and the tradition of a crude, romantic patriotism on the other. At first people received the fact with an irresponsible detachment, much as they would have received the slowing down of the train in which they were traveling, or the erection of a public monument by the city to which they belonged. "We have surrendered." "Dear me, have we?" was rather the manner in which the first news was met. They took it in the same spectacular spirit they had displayed at the first apparition of the air fleet. Only slowly was this realization of a capitulation suffused with the flush of passion, only with reflection, did they make any personal application. "E have surrendered," came later, "and us America is defeated." Then they began to burn and tingle. The newspapers, which were issued about 1 in the morning, contained no particulars of the terms upon which New York had yielded, nor did they give any intimation of the quality of the brief conflict that had preceded the capitulation. The later issues remedied these deficiencies. There came the explicit statement of the agreement to victual the German airships, to supply the complement of explosives, to replace those employed in the fight and in the destruction of the North Atlantic fleet, to pay the enormous ransom of $40 million, and to surrender the in the East River. There came, too, longer and longer descriptions of the smashing up of the City Hall and the Navy Yard, and people began to realize faintly what those brief minutes of uproar had meant. They read the tale of men blown to bits, of futile soldiers in that localized battle fighting against hope amidst an indescribable wreckage, of flags hauled down by weeping men. And these strange nocturnal editions contained also the first brief cables from Europe of the fleet disaster, the North Atlantic fleet for which New York had always felt an especial pride and solicitude. Slowly, hour by hour, the collective consciousness woke up. The tide of patriotic astonishment and humiliation came floating in. America had come upon disaster. Suddenly New York discovered herself with amazement, giving place to wrath unspeakable, a conquered city under the hand of her conqueror. As that fact shaped itself in the public mind, there sprang up, a flame sprang up, an angry repudiation. "Oh!" cried New York, waking in the dawn. "Oh! I am not defeated. This is a dream." Before day broke, the swift American anger was running through all the city, through every soul in those contagious millions. Before it took action, before it took shape, the men in the airships could feel the gigantic insurgence of emotion, as cattle and natural creatures feel, it is said, the coming of an earthquake. The newspapers of the Knipe Group first gave the thing words and a formula. "We do not agree," they said simply. "We have been betrayed." Men took that up everywhere, it passed from mouth to mouth, at every street corner under the paling lights of dawn orators stood unchecked, calling upon the spirit of America to arise, making the shame a personal reality to everyone who heard. To Bert, listening 500 feet above, it seemed that the city, which had at first produced only confused noises, was now humming like a hive of bees, of very angry bees. After the smashing of the city hall and post office, the white flag had been hoisted from a tower of the old Park Row building, and thither had gone Mayor O'Hagan, urged thither indeed by the terror-stricken property owners of Lower New York, to negotiate the capitulation with von Winterfeld. The Vaterland, having dropped the secretary by a rope ladder, remained hovering, circling very slowly above the great buildings, old and new, that clustered round City Hall Park, while the Helmels, which had done the fighting there, rose overhead to a height of perhaps 2,000 feet. So Bert had a near view of all that occurred in that central place. The City Hall and Courthouse, the post office and a mass of buildings on the west side of Broadway, had been badly damaged, and the three former were a heap of blackened ruins. In the case of the first two, the loss of life had not been considerable, but a great multitude of workers, including many girls and women, had been caught in the destruction of the post office, and a little army of volunteers with white badges entered behind the firemen, bringing out the often still living bodies, for the most part frightfully charred, and carrying them into the big Monson building close at hand. Everywhere the busy firemen were directing their bright streams of water upon the smoldering masses. Their hose lay about the square, and long cordons of police held back the gathering black masses of people, chiefly from the east side, from the central activities. In violent and extraordinary contrast with this scene of destruction, close at hand, were the huge newspaper establishments of Park Row. They were all alight and working. They had not been abandoned, even while the actual bomb throwing was going on, and now staff and presses were vehemently active, getting out the story, the immense and dreadful story of the night, developing comment, and, in most cases, spreading the idea of resistance under the very noses of the airships. For a long time Bert could not imagine what these callously active offices could be, then he detected the noise of the presses, and emitted his awe. Beyond these newspaper buildings again, and partially hidden by the arches of the old elevated railway of New York long since converted into a monorail, there was another cordon of police, and a sort of encampment of ambulances and doctors, busy with the dead and wounded who had been killed early in the night by the panic upon Brooklyn Bridge. All this he saw in the perspectives of a bird's eye view, as things happening in a big, irregular-shaped pit below him, between cliffs of high building. Northward he looked along the steep canyon of Broadway, down whose length at intervals crowds were assembling about excited speakers. And when he lifted his eyes he saw the chimneys and cable stacks, and roof spaces of New York, and everywhere now over these the watching, debating people clustered, except where the fires raged and the jets of water flew. Everywhere, too, were flagstaffs devoid of flags. One white sheet drooped and flapped and drooped again over the Park Row buildings. and upon the lurid lights, the festering movement and intense shadows of this strange scene, there was breaking now the cold, impartial dawn. For Bert Smallways all this was framed in the frame of the open porthole. It was a pale, dim world outside that dark and tangible rim. All night he had clutched at that rim, jumped and quivered at explosions, and watched phantom events. Now he had been high and now low, now almost beyond hearing, now flying close to crashings and shouts and outcries. He had seen airships flying low and swift over darkened and groaning streets, watched great buildings, suddenly red lit amidst the shadows, crumple at the smashing impact of bombs, witnessed for the first time in his life the grotesque, swift onset of insatiable conflagrations. From it all he felt detached, disembodied. The Vaterland did not even fling a bomb, she watched and ruled. Then down they had come at last, to hover over City Hall Park, and it had crept in upon his mind, chillingly, terrifyingly, that these illuminated black masses were great offices of fire, and that the going to and fro of minute, dim specters of lantern lit gray and white was a harvesting of the wounded and the dead. As the light grew clearer, he began to understand more and more what these crumpled black things signified. He had watched hour after hour since first New York had risen out of the blue indistinctness of the landfall. With the daylight he experienced an intolerable fatigue. He lifted weary eyes to the pink flush in the sky, yawned immensely, and crawled back whispering to himself across the cabin to the locker. He did not so much lie down upon that as fall upon it, and instantly become asleep. There, hours after, sprawling undignified and sleeping profoundly, Kurt found him, a very image of the democratic mind confronted with the problems of a time too complex for its apprehension. His face was pale and indifferent, his mouth wide open, and he snored. He snored disagreeably. Kurt regarded him for a moment with a mild distaste. Then he kicked his ankle. "Wake up," he said to Smallways stare, "and lie down decent." Bert sat up and rubbed his eyes. "Any more fighting yet?" he asked. "No," said Kurt, and sat down, a tired man. "God," he cried presently, rubbing his hands over his face, "but I'd like a cold bath. I've been looking for stray bullet holes in the air chambers all night until now." He yawned. "Must sleep. You'd better clear out, Smallways. I can't stand you here this morning. You're so infernally ugly and useless. Have you had your rations?" "No." "Well, go in and get them, and don't come back. Stick in the gallery." 5. So Bert, slightly refreshed by coffee and sleep, resumed his helpless cooperation in the war in the air. He went down into the little gallery as the lieutenant had directed, and clung to the rail at the extreme end beyond the lookout man, trying to seem as inconspicuous and harmless a fragment of life as possible. A wind was rising rather strongly from the southeast. It obliged the Vaterland to come about in that direction, and made her roll a great deal as she went to and fro over Manhattan Island. Away in the northwest clouds gathered. The throb-throb of her slow screw working against the breeze was much more perceptible than when she was going full speed ahead, and the friction of the wind against the underside of the gas chamber drove a series of shallow ripples along it, and made a faint flapping sound like, but fainter than, the beating of ripples under the stem of a boat. She was stationed over the temporary City Hall in the Park Row building, and every now and then she would descend to resume communication with the mayor and with Washington. But the restlessness of the prince would not suffer him to remain for long in any one place. Now he would circle over the Hudson and East River, now he would go up high, as if to peer away into the blue distances. Once he ascended so swiftly and so far, that mountain sickness overtook him, and the crew, and forced him down again, and Bert shared the dizziness and nausea. The swaying view varied with these changes of altitude. Now they would be low and close, and he would distinguish in that steep, unusual perspective, windows, doors, street, and sky signs, people and the minute's details, and watch the enigmatical behavior of crowds and clusters upon the roofs and in the streets. Then as they sort, the details would shrink, the sides of streets draw together, the view widen, the people cease to be significant. At the highest, the effect was that of a concave relief map. Bert saw the dark and crowded land everywhere intersected by shining waters, saw the Hudson River like a spear of silver, and Lower Island Sound like a shield. Even to Bert's unphilosophical mind, the contrast of city below and fleet above pointed an opposition, the opposition of the adventurous American's tradition and character with German order and discipline. Below, the immense buildings, tremendous and fine as they were, seemed like the giant trees of a jungle fighting for life. Their picturesque magnificence was as planless as the chances of crag and gorge, their casualty enhanced by the smoke and confusion of still unsubdued and spreading conflagrations. In the sky, soared the German airships like beings in a different, entirely more orderly world, all oriented to the same angle of the horizon, uniform in build and appearance, moving accurately with one purpose as a pack of wolves will move, distributed with the most precise and effectual cooperation. It dawned upon Bert that hardly a third of the fleet was visible. The others had gone upon errands he could not imagine, beyond the compass of that great circle of earth and sky. He wondered, but there was no one to ask. As the day wore on, about a dozen reappeared in the east with their stores replenished from the flotilla and towing a number of Drachen Voyager. Towards afternoon the weather thickened, driving clouds appeared in the southwest, and ran together, and seemed to engender more clouds, and the wind came round into that quarter and blew stronger. Towards the evening the wind became a gale into which the now tossing airships had to beat. All that day the prince was negotiating with Washington, while his detached scouts sought far and wide over the eastern states looking for anything resembling an aeronautic park. A squadron of 20 airships detached overnight had dropped out of the air upon Niagara and was holding the town and power works. Meanwhile, the insurrectionary movement in the giant city grew uncontrollable. In spite of 5 great fires already involving many acres, and spreading steadily, New York was still not satisfied that she was beaten. At first the rebellious spirit below found vent only in isolated shouts, street crowd speeches, and newspaper suggestions. Then it found much more definite expression in the appearance in the morning sunlight of American flags at point after point above the architectural cliffs of the city. It is quite possible that in many cases this spirited display of bunting by a city already surrendered was the outcome of the innocent informality of the American mind, but it is also undeniable that in many it was a deliberate indication that the people felt wicked. The German sense of correctitude was deeply shocked by this outbreak. The Graf von Winterfeld immediately communicated with the mayor, and pointed out the irregularity, and the fire lookout stations were instructed in the matter. The New York police was speedily hard at work, and a foolish contest in full swing between impassioned citizens resolved to keep the flag flying, and irritated and worried officers instructed to pull it down. The trouble became acute at last in the streets above Columbia University. The captain of the airship watching this quarter seems to have stooped to lasso and drag from its staff a flag hoisted upon Morgan Hall. As he did, so a volley of rifle and revolver shots was fired from the upper windows of the huge apartment building that stands between the university and Riverside Drive. Most of these were ineffectual, but 2 or 3 perforated gas chambers, and one smashed the hand and arm of a man upon the forward platform. The sentinel on the lower gallery immediately replied, and the machine gun on the shield of the Eagle let fly and promptly stopped any further shots. The airship rose and signaled the flagship and City Hall. Police and militiamen were directed at once to the spot, and this particular incident closed. But hard upon that came the desperate attempt of a party of young clubmen from New York, who, inspired by patriotic and adventurous imaginations, slipped off in half a dozen motor cars to Beacon Hill, and set to work with remarkable vigor, to improvise a fort about the Doan swivel gun that had been placed there. They found it still in the hands of the disgusted gunners, who had been ordered to cease fire at the capitulation, and it was easy to infect these men with their own spirit. They declared their gun hadn't had half a chance, and were burning to show what it could do. Directed by the newcomers, they made a trench and bank about the mounting of the piece, and constructed flimsy shelter pits of corrugated iron. They were actually loading the gun, when they were observed by the airship Priusen, and the shell they succeeded in firing before the bombs of the latter smashed them and their crude defenses to fragments, burst over the middle gas chambers of the Bingen, and brought her to earth, disabled, upon Staten Island. She was badly deflated, and dropped among trees, over which her empty central gas bag spread in canopies and festoons. Nothing, however, had caught fire, and her men were speedily at work upon her repair. They behaved with a confidence that verged upon indiscretion. While most of them commenced patching the tears of the membrane, half a dozen of them started off for the nearest road in search of a gas main, and presently found themselves prisoners in the hands of a hostile crowd. Close at H, and was a number of villa residences, whose occupants speedily developed from an unfriendly curiosity to aggression. At that time the police control of the large polyglot population of Staten Island had become very lax, and scarcely a household but had its rifle or pistols and ammunition. These were presently produced, and after two or three misses, one of the men at work was hit in the foot. Thereupon the Germans left their sewing and mending, took cover among the trees, and replied. The crackling of shots speedily brought the Priusen and Kiel on the scene, and with a few hand grenades they made short work of every villa within a mile. A number of non-combatant American men, women, and children were killed, and the actual assailants driven off. For a time the repairs went on in peace under the immediate protection of these two airships. Then when they returned to their quarters, an intermittent sniping and fighting round the stranded Bingen was resumed, and went on all the afternoon, and merged at last in the general combat of the evening. About 8 the Bingen was rushed by an armed mob, and all its defenders killed after a fierce, disorderly struggle. The difficulty of the Germans in both these cases came from the impossibility of landing any efficient force, or, indeed, any force at all from the air fleet. The airships were quite unequal to the transport of any adequate landing parties. Their complement of men was just sufficient to maneuver and fight them in the air. From above they could inflict immense damage. They could reduce any organized government to a capitulation in the briefest space, but they could not disarm, much less could they occupy, the surrendered areas below. They had to trust to the pressure upon the authorities below of a threat to renew the bombardment. It was their sole resource. No doubt, with a highly organized and undamaged government, and a homogeneous and well-disciplined people, that would have sufficed to keep the peace. But this was not the American case. Not only was the New York government a weak one and insufficiently provided with police, but the destruction of the City Hall and Post Office and other central ganglia had hopelessly disorganized the cooperation of part with part. The streetcars and railways had ceased, the telephone service was out of gear and only worked intermittently. The Germans had struck at the head, and the head was conquered and stunned, only to release the body from its rule. New York had become a headless monster, no longer capable of collective submission. Everywhere it lifted itself rebelliously. Everywhere authorities and officials left to their own imitative were joining in the arming and flag hoisting and excitement of that afternoon. 6. The disintegrating truce gave place to a definite general breach with the assassination of the Wetterhorn 4, that is the only possible word for the act above Union Square, and not a mile away from the exemplary ruins of City Hall. This occurred late in the afternoon, between 5 and 6. By that time the weather had changed very much for the worse, and the operations of the airships were embarrassed by the necessity they were under of keeping head on to the gusts. A series of squalls, with hail and thunder, followed one another from the south by southeast, and in order to avoid these as much as possible, the air fleet came low over the houses, diminishing its range of observation and exposing itself to a rifle attack. Overnight there had been a gun placed in Union Square. It had never been mounted, much less fired, and in the darkness after the surrender it was taken with its supplies and put out of the way under the arches of the Great Dexter Building. Here late in the morning it was remarked by a number of patriotic spirits. They set to work to hoist and mount it inside the upper floors of the place. They made, in fact, a masked battery behind the decorous office blinds, and there lay in wait as simply excited as children until at last the stem of the luckless weather horn appeared, beating and rolling at quarter speed over the recently reconstructed pinnacles of Tiffany's. Promptly that one gun battery unmasked. The airship's lookout man must have seen the whole of the 10th story of the Dexter Building crumble out, and smash in the street below to discover the black muzzle looking out from the shadows behind. Then perhaps the shell hit him. The gun fired two shells before the frame of the Dexter Building collapsed, and each shell raked the weather horn from stem to stern. They smashed her exhaustively. She crumpled up like a can that has been kicked by a heavy boot. Her forepart came down in the square, and the rest of her length, with a great snapping and twisting of shafts and stays, descended, collapsing athwart Tammany Hall and the streets toward 2nd Avenue. Her gas escaped to mix with air, and the air of her rent ballonet poured into her deflating gas chambers. Then with an immense impact she exploded. The Vaterland at that time was beating up to the south of City Hall from over the ruins of the Brooklyn Bridge, and the reports of the gun, followed by the first crashes of the collapsing Dexter Building, brought Kurt and Smallways to the cabin porthole. They were in time to see the flash of the exploding gun, and then they were first flattened against the window, and then rolled head over heels across the floor of the cabin by the airwave of the explosion. The Vaterland bounded like a football someone has kicked, and when they looked out again, Union Square was small, and remote and shattered, as though some cosmically vast giant had rolled over it. The buildings to the east of it were ablaze at a dozen points, under the flaming tatters and warping skeleton of the airship, and all the roofs and walls were ridiculously askew and crumbling as one looked. "Ah," said Bert. "That's happened? Look at the people." But before Kurt could produce an explanation, the shrill bells of the airship were ringing to quarters, and he had to go. Bert hesitated and stepped thoughtfully into the passage, looking back at the window as he did so. He was knocked off his feet at once by the Prince, who was rushing headlong from his cabin to the Central magazine. Bert had a momentary impression of the great figure of the Prince, white with rage, bristling with gigantic anger, his huge fist swinging. "Blood-undizen!" cried the Prince, as one who swears. "H. Blood-undizen!" Someone fell over Bert. Something in the manner of falling suggested von Winterfeld, and someone else paused, and kicked him spitefully and hard. Then he was sitting up in the passage, rubbing a freshly bruised cheek and readjusting the bandage he still wore on his head. "Am that Prince," said Bert, indignant beyond measure. "He hasn't the manners of a hog." He stood up, collected his wits for a minute, and then went slowly towards the gangway of the little gallery. As he did so, he heard noises suggestive of the return of the Prince. The lot of them were coming back again. He shot into his cabin like a rabbit into its burrow, just in time to escape that shouting terror. He shut the door, waited until the passage was still, then went across to the window and looked out. A drift of cloud made the prospect of the streets and squares hazy, and the rolling of the airship swung the picture up and down. A few people were running to and fro, but for the most part the aspect of the district was desertion. The streets seemed to broaden out, they became clearer, and the little dots that were people larger as the Vaderland came down again. Presently she was swaying along above the lower end of Broadway. The dots below, Bert saw, were not running now, but standing and looking up. Then suddenly they were all running again. Something had dropped from the aeroplane, something that looked small and flimsy. It hit the pavement near a big archway just underneath Bert. A little man was sprinting along the sidewalk within half a dozen yards, and two or three others and one woman were bolting across the roadway. They were odd little figures, so very small were they about the heads, so very active about the elbows and legs. It was really funny to see their legs going. Foreshortened, humanity has no dignity. The little man on the pavement jumped comically, no doubt with terror, as the bomb fell beside him. Then blinding flames squirted out in all directions from the point of impact, and the little man who had jumped became, for an instant, a flash of fire and vanished absolutely. The people running out into the road took preposterous clumsy leaps, then flopped down and lay still, with their torn clothes smoldering into flame. Then pieces of the archway began to drop, and the lower masonry of the building, to fall in with the rumbling sound of coals being shot into a cellar. A faint screaming reached Bert, and then a crowd of people ran out into the street, one man limping and gesticulating awkwardly. He halted, and went back towards the building. A falling mass of brickwork hit him, and sent him sprawling to lie still, and crumpled where he fell. Dust and black smoke came pouring into the street, and were presently shot with red flame. In this manner the massacre of New York began. She was the first of the great cities of the scientific age to suffer by the enormous powers and grotesque limitations of aerial warfare. She was wrecked as in the previous century endless barbaric cities had been bombarded, because she was at once too strong to be occupied, and too undisciplined and proud to surrender in order to escape destruction. Given the circumstances, the thing had to be done. It was impossible for the prince to desist, and own himself defeated, and it was impossible to subdue the city except by largely destroying it. The catastrophe was the logical outcome of the situation, created by the application of science to warfare. It was unavoidable that great cities should be destroyed. In spite of his intense exasperation with his dilemma, the prince sought to be moderate even in massacre. He tried to give a memorable lesson with the minimum waste of life, and the minimum expenditure of explosives. For that night he proposed only the wrecking of Broadway. He directed the air fleet to move in column over the route of this thoroughfare, dropping bombs, the Vaderland leading. And so our Bert Smallways became a participant in one of the most cold-blooded slaughters in the world's history, in which men who were neither excited, nor, except for the remotest chance of a bullet, in any danger, poured death and destruction upon homes and crowds below. He clung to the frame of the porthole as the airship tossed and swayed, and stared down through the light rain that now drove before the wind, into the twilight streets, watching people running out of the houses, watching buildings collapse and fires begin. As the airships sailed along, they smashed up the city as a child will shatter its cities of brick and card. Below, they left ruins and blazing conflagrations and heaped and scattered dead. Men, women, and children mixed together, as though they had been no more than Moors, or Zulus, or Chinese. Lower New York was soon a furnace of crimson flames, from which there was no escape. Cars, railways, ferries, all had ceased, and never a light lit the way of the distracted fugitives in that dusky confusion, but the light of burning. He had glimpses of what it must mean to be down there, glimpses. And it came to him suddenly as an incredible discovery, that such disasters were not only possible now in this strange, gigantic, foreign New York, but also in London in Bun Hill. That the little island in the Silver Seas was at the end of its immunity, that nowhere in the world anymore was there a place left, where a Smallways might lift his head proudly, and vote for war and a spirited foreign policy, and go secure from such horrible things. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.